problem service among jury members in Ted Stevens' trial. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, the 23rd of October. Good evening, I'm Duncan Moon. Also tonight, 18 bottles of the so-called date rape drug ketamine go missing in Sitka.
It has a tendency to leave a person with feelings of dissociation and the inability to communicate, which is why it's used as a date rape drug.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Condor Airlines, offering nonstop service to Frankfurt from Anchorage and Fairbanks between May and September, with connections to most German and European destinations. Details available at condor.com.
APRN will be providing special coverage of the 50th anniversary of Alaska statehood. For sponsorship information, call 550-8400.
Jury deliberations wrapped up their second day today in the trial of Alaska Senator Ted Stevens with no verdict. They halted temporarily at midday when 11 of the 12 jurors asked that the 12th juror be removed. That situation appears to be resolved, but it's part of a pattern of intense deliberations. As APRN's Libby Casey reports, issues with jurors continued after hours tonight in Washington, D.C.
The court convened a last-minute hearing Thursday night to talk about a juror. Juror number 4 has a family member who's gravely ill or possibly deceased. The juror called the court Thursday night to say she may not be able to attend deliberations on Friday. Judge Emmett Sullivan hasn't been able to reach her, but gathered the lawyers together to talk about what to do next. Stevens showed up with a crew of 6 defense lawyers, all still in suits and ties for the after-hours hearing, while only prosecutor Joseph Bettini represented the government. The judge said he's willing to accommodate the juror, but first needs to find out more about her situation. So the lawyers will meet again Friday morning to talk. 4 things could happen. The juror could return to court after all Friday, ready to deliberate, and things could proceed. Deliberations could be put off for a day to accommodate her, pushing the trial into its 6th week. Or Judge Sullivan could replace the juror with one of the alternates. He could also choose to reduce the jury pool down to 11 and let the rest of the group go on deciding Stevens' fate. Regardless of what happens, deliberations are proving not to be a speedy process. They're also a stressful one for some on the jury. Midday Thursday, the foreman wrote a note to the judge that one of the jurors had violent outbursts and was not following the laws and rules. The rest of the jury wanted her removed for being, quote, rude, disrespectful, and unreasonable. Jurors' names are not made public. She's known only as Juror Number 9, a middle-aged African-American woman who's a bookkeeper with the National Guard. Judge Sullivan considered bringing out the foreman to ask about his use of the word violent out of concern for jurors' safety. But after consulting with lawyers on both sides, he decided instead only to remind the entire jury of their responsibility and give them what he called a pep talk. Sullivan told them to encourage civility and mutual respect and said they should promote full and fair consideration of the evidence. Once the jury panel had retreated to continue deliberating, Sullivan remarked that the group was smiling as he spoke to them, and no one seemed agitated at his instruction. The jury sent 3 other notes back to the judge Thursday. One asked for a missing page of the indictment, while another asked the court to clarify liability costs in Senate regulations. Stevens was required to list on his Senate forms any liabilities or debts over $10,000, and the government says he illegally withheld that information. But the judge sent jurors a note saying he could not provide them with additional instructions. They'll have to find that information in the evidence they already have. The jury's final note Thursday asked if they could go home slightly early. The judge has to assemble the lawyers whenever he gets a note, so both parties and the media hastily convened to hear what the jury had to say. The note read, quote, "We have given the evidence consideration and have exhausted ourselves for this day." In a little juror humor, and perhaps with a nod to the judge's earlier instructions to get along, the foreman wrote, quote, "We are unanimous in requesting we break." Judge Sullivan allowed them to leave about 15 minutes early. Whether or not they'll continue deliberating Friday remains to be seen. Every day the jury takes to deliberate is another day Stevens is stuck in D.C., waiting for a verdict, instead of campaigning to retain his seat back in Alaska. In Washington, I'm Libby Casey.
Judge Sullivan had to walk a careful line in making his decision about how to handle the jury problems today. Cliff Groh is an Alaskan with 30 years' experience both as a criminal defense lawyer and as a prosecutor. He's been covering the trial and is blogging about it at AlaskaCorruptionBlogspot.com. I caught up with him a few minutes ago and asked what other options the judge had to consider other than admonishing the jury and sending it back to work.
Things that the judge considered and has so far not done are interviewing the foreman, the man, I think in private life, a drug rehabilitation counselor who's the foreman of the jury, and interviewing him in court about, you know, his concerns. The judge is particularly concerned about the violent outbursts, although as an appeal point, a point on appeal, the not following laws and rules was a particular problem as well, lawyers in the courtroom recognized. The judge also discussed the possibility of interviewing the juror whose conduct has been questioned, and so far he hasn't done that either. And then finally, the prosecution raised the possibility of dismissal of the juror and bringing back one of the four alternates to continue deliberations. There are 16 jurors who sat through the entire trial, and just yesterday, four were released, and the judge told them, hey, you're off the case for right now, but I understand you could be brought back. So still don't listen to any media reports. Don't listen to the radio or watch TV or read any accounts or talk to the case with anyone.
What sort of problems would there be with that?
Well, one possible concern is, despite all the judges' warnings and admonishments, it's harder as a practical human matter for someone to told that they're no longer on the jury, but they might get called back, for them not to actually get tainted, right? Talk to somebody, their friends or family members, and hear what friends or family members told them about the media coverage, or even, frankly, read newspapers or listen to the radio or watch TV, because they don't really think they'll be called back. So there's that possibility of taint, even despite the warnings or admonishment. And then finally, there's a big concern that would be raised about the outcome and the process of having 11 jurors essentially fire a 12th. And because if there was a conviction of Senator Stevens, his defense team would certainly argue on appeal that, hey, that was the juror that was acquitted Senator Stevens, right? And what really happened is that 11 jurors imposed their views of the evidence or their views of what the ultimate outcome of the trial should be on a 12th, and that's, terribly and grossly unfair. So that's a very tricky thing to think about as well. And then, of course, if there was a dismissal of a jury, I've heard and give cases where both sides agree to have the remaining 11 make a decision. But that can, there's some issues there, legal issues there as well.
Let me ask you this. You've got two sets of lawyers on one set on each side watching this unfold. What are they thinking and how are they playing this?
In terms of the kinds of considerations they're thinking about, the prosecution very much wants a verdict. Obviously, they want a verdict of guilty on one or more counts. The defense lawyers very much want anything else, anything but a conviction, is a big victory for them. And this is where, frankly, the interests of Senator Stevens and his lawyers somewhat diverge, or the lawyers would not admit it. The defense attorneys would be ecstatic over hung jury. I also think and understand the defense attorneys are often very happy and internally gleeful about each sort of difficult decision the judge has to make, because if Senator Stevens was convicted, that various decisions that the judges made can be grounds for appeal and appellate points. And I'll tell you that that's not what Senator Stevens wants, because you can only have an appeal in a criminal case if the defendant gets convicted. And any conviction has got to be very bad news for him, even if it were reversed a year or 2 years later.
All right, Cliff, thanks so much for joining us tonight.
I hope I've helped, Duncan, and all the best, and thanks a lot.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, exploring possible fuel price gouging in Alaska.
We simply don't have a price gouging law in Alaska. You can price it as a retailer on whatever the market will bear.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. In celebration of Alaska's 50th anniversary of statehood, the Governor's Legacy Dinner will be held on November 14th at the Hotel Captain Cook. All eight of the living governors of Alaska will be in attendance for this elegant and prestigious event. Enjoy world-class entertainment, gourmet dining, and special anniversary gifts. For more information and to make your reservation to the Alaska Governor's Legacy Dinner, log on to alaskaturns50.com. This message sponsored by the Anchorage Statehood Celebration Committee.
The Alaska Federation of Natives annual convention kicked off today at the new Dedina Convention Center in downtown Anchorage. The convention draws thousands of Alaska Natives from across the state. This year's theme is Reaching for the Stars, Native Aspirations for the 21st Century. APRN's Lori Townsend is at the convention, and she joins us now. Lori, how did the day begin?
Hi, Duncan. Well, the day started off with honoring of veterans. There was a tremendous procession of the Territorial Guard, Army, Marines, Navy, Coast Guard, and all these veterans. It was quite fun. All the veterans came through and just sort of streamed all the way through this enormous convention room. The Merchant Marines were also honored. They've just been recognized recently as veterans. And then we moved on after the colors were retired. We moved on to an honoring of Tlingit Elder Reverend Dr. Walter Sobolev as he approaches being 100 years old in November. Then we heard addresses from AFN President Julie Kitka, Mayor Mark Begich, Fairbanks Mayor Whitaker. Governor Palin spoke by video, and Senator Lisa Murkowski was here.
So you've got all these elected officials who flock around. What did they have to say?
Well, the main message, the theme may be reaching for the stars, but the main message was energy and the energy crisis in rural Alaska. AFN President Julie Kitka said, Alaska is one of the richest states in the nation, and there's really no reason that these energy, law enforcement, and healthcare delivery problems aren't being more adequately addressed in rural Alaska. Mayor Whitaker spoke in very strong terms. He just had a very brief speech, but the main message of his talk was that we need to demand, he said, use the word demand, that the legislature use surplus funds to address this energy issue now. Governor Palin announced the creation of a new sub-cabinet comprised of state department commissioners, and they'll be looking at rural energy and the issue of out-migration that seems to be increasing lately. And Senator Murkowski, she talked a lot about people in villages paying 40% of their income for energy and how difficult it is for her to get people in Washington, D.C. to understand what that means. They just can't grasp it, she said. She said that although out-migration has been going on for a long time from the villages in Alaska, the indications are that it's increasing, and it's more out of necessity or lack of options rather than a choice. And she said no one should be forced to have to move.
Lori, I understand there was a veterans forum in the afternoon focusing on things like improving VA health care, delivery to veterans in rural Alaska. What did the delegates learn about that?
Well, Duncan, a lot of Alaskans may know that Alaska has the highest number of veterans per capita of any other state, and about 15% of them live in rural Alaska. There was a lot of talk about instituting new programs. One of them, Lieutenant General Craig Campbell with the state Military and Veterans Affairs Department, talked about a program that was developed in Minnesota called the Yellow Ribbon Program, and they're implementing that here in Alaska now, where returning vets check in for PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder examinations, and other psychological evaluations on a 30, 60, and 90-day schedule so that they keep reconnecting with veterans to see how's it going, how are you doing, are any problems cropping up, to see how people are doing in a more long-term sense rather than just a quick evaluation when they first come back. And there was a lot of conversation about collaborations between the VA and the IHS, the Indian Health Service. The VA only has clinics in Anchorage, Fairbanks, Kenai, and now soon they'll have clinics in Wausau and Juneau. But there are IHS facilities in a lot of clinics in, or IHS clinics in a lot of places in rural Alaska. And they're working on collaborative programs now where the IHS can address some of the veterans' needs at those clinics so that they don't have to always come into urban centers.
All right, Lori, what are the delegates going to be working on tomorrow?
Duncan, it will be more energy discussion. They'll be talking about what Native organizations are doing to address the crisis of fossil fuel costs. They'll be looking, there'll be a panel on what federal and state and local governments can do to address it, and also looking at the impacts of the energy crisis on public facilities, and also a panel on renewable energy resources. Where are they, and how can they be developed? And there's also going to be some dancing and lots of other festivities. There's lots and lots of people here, and everyone's having a great time at the new convention center.
Always a full agenda. Thanks, Lori.
Thanks, Duncan.
APRN's Lori Townsend at the Dena'ina Convention Center here in Anchorage. Legislators are beginning to consider whether the state needs any new tools in dealing with high fuel prices. In the second in an ongoing series of hearings on the disparity between Alaska and the lower 48 gasoline and diesel prices, the House Judiciary Committee today heard from the Department of Law's investigation into price fixing among distributors and refineries. From Juneau, APRN's Dave Donaldson reports.
Legislators agree there's one subject everyone wants to know about on the campaign trail this year, the cost of gasoline and home heating oil. Lawmakers say the public does not understand why prices go up quickly and decrease slowly in comparison to worldwide market prices. Members of the House Judiciary Committee say constituents are angry, they're impatient, and they want the state to help. Assistant Attorney General Ed Sniffen says he's among the state's outraged consumers. He's heading the Department of Law's investigation into fuel prices, and he says the state is hampered by not having any way to control those prices.
We simply don't have a price gouging law in Alaska. Consumers need to understand that we do not live in a cost-plus society. So no matter what it costs you to produce that gallon of gasoline, you don't have to price that gallon of gasoline based on your cost. You can price it as a retailer on whatever the market will bear. It's whatever consumers are willing to pay for it. It's whatever your competitors are going to price their product at to keep you, within a reasonable, range.
Consumers don't seem to do all they could to help themselves either. Sniffen says fuel demand generally has remained constant in Alaska, regardless of the price. And in the lower 48, demand has dropped so much that there are some areas where there's actually a gasoline surplus. In Alaska, marketers don't feel the downside of the market. And Sniffen says if customers continue to pay high prices, the marketer has no incentive or requirement to reduce them.
The limitations are essentially our antitrust laws, and that is you can't set your prices as a result of a price-fixing conduct or collusion or coordinated activity.
He says it's hard to find collusion or price-fixing, and laws preventing price gouging would be very risky and difficult to write on any product, not just fuel. Those states that have limits trigger the illegal activity by a declared emergency, and they place limits on price increases after that declaration. Sniffen says if there were such legislation, it would have to focus on the refineries, and it would be a complete regulation of prices. He says the consequences of that could be severe.
The worst case scenario would be the refineries would just shut down. They might get to the point where they say, We're not turning a buck. We're not going to stay in Alaska. Thank you very much. We're going to invest our capital elsewhere. If it didn't have that impact immediately, you could suffer some decline in quality, reliability. Perhaps some long-term contracts for fuel might not get filled. So people down in Haines, they don't get fuel for their fishing boats for a while. Or a lot of things I think like that are potentially on the horizon with that kind of legislation.
Economist Barry Pulliam, who's previously worked with the legislature as a consultant on gas line issues with Econ One Research, gave the same warning. He advised against regulating prices. He says Hawaii tried putting a cap on gasoline prices, but since has let the statute lapse.
You control typically things that are considered to be natural monopolies. here I don't think you have a natural monopoly. There is some more competition than that. I would say if you venture into it, do so with extreme caution. Extreme caution.
The committee plans to hold future meetings on fuel prices every month, with hopes of next year's legislature picking up the task of monitoring prices after it's reorganized next year. I'm Dave Donaldson in Juneau.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. If heating your home costs more than you can manage and you have a low income, the state of Alaska has heating assistance programs that may help. The programs have expanded to include families with a higher household income. For information or an application form, call 1-800-470-3058 or visit heatinghelp.alaska.gov. Sometimes a little help makes all the difference. This message is sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services.
Sitka police have issued a public safety alert after 18 bottles of ketamine, a drug that's often used as a date rape drug, were stolen from a local clinic. Lieutenant Barry Allen says the bottles of ketamine were discovered missing on October 10th and then reported to police as stolen that same day.
Medically, it's used as an anesthetic, you know, especially in veterinary medicine. It's a stimulant and a depressant and a hallucinogenic, and it's got analgesic properties. The biggest concern is the withdrawal effects after the drug starts wearing off. It has a tendency to leave a person with feelings of dissociation and the inability to communicate, which is why it's used as a date rape drug.
Allen says about 4 years ago, there were various incidents of something being slipped into women's drinks at local bars, and several women developed symptoms that are common with another drug, GHB, which tests positive as a methamphetamine.
You know, what was going on the last time is it kind of appeared that they were overdosing people, because what would happen is they would start getting very intoxicated after a half a beer to a, you know, a couple beers, and then they'd start getting extremely nauseated, and, you know, it would last for, you know, the next 24 hours or so. And then one of the women had talked to me, you know, a week afterwards and was still experiencing some symptoms from it.
Ketamine could have similar effects to GHB, which includes nausea and vomiting, and an overdose can cause severe hallucinogenic episodes or dissociative feelings with prolonged effects. The drug is used recreationally because it produces a mellow, dreamy state. Allen says with the amount of ketamine that was stolen, people should be vigilant about where and with whom they drink, especially with the upcoming holiday weekend. He says it's important to remember that this can and has happened in Sitka.
Just make sure that you're watching your drinks and, you know, not letting anybody have time alone with them, because that's what was happening before. Was as soon as somebody turned their back on their beer or something, and this stuff was getting slipped into their drink. You know, I don't know that it will be used that way, but it's definitely got the potential. And just with the sheer volume of it out there, that's my biggest concern.
If anyone suspects they have been slipped something, they should seek medical attention immediately. It is important to get a drug screen done with the first 12 to 24 hours or as soon as possible in order to identify the substance. Avalanche season is just around the corner in Juneau, where snow is starting to accumulate on the mountains above town. City officials hope to hire an urban avalanche forecaster this week. The Juneau Assembly approved $55,000 for the avalanche forecasting program. State and federal funds will provide another $55,000. Juneau had America's only urban avalanche warning program 2 winters ago, but did not fund the program last winter. The Southeast Alaska Avalanche Center board member Bob Janes urged the city to get the new program running immediately.
Right now, they should be collecting data on the snowpack. There's snow on the ground now. We don't know how much is up on top of Mount Juneau at 3,000-foot elevation.
Juneau's power company has hired the firm Alaska Avalanche Specialist to protect the power line between Juneau and its main hydroelectric plant. Alaska Electric Light and Power spokesman Scott Willis says he's budgeted $300,000 for the season.
There will be people monitoring day by day what the weather is, what the snowfall is, assessing the condition of the snowpack, and probably after every storm, flying out to Snettisham and dropping bombs from a helicopter to bring down small amounts of snow.
Small avalanches aren't a problem for the transmission line between Juneau and the Snettisham hydropower plant, but unusually large avalanches in April obliterated transmission towers and old-growth forests with 400-year-old trees. AELNP has also hired an Anchorage engineering firm to study longer-term avalanche protections for the Snettisham line. Scott Willis says the study should be completed after the first of the year, but any structural protections are at least 2 or 3 years down the line. That's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at aprn.org. We'd love to hear your comments about the show. To send us your thoughts, go to aprn.org, scroll down to the bottom of the page, and click on the Contact Us link. Be sure to tell us if we can use your comments on the air, and if so, how to pronounce your name. We had reports tonight from Bonnie Sue Hitchcock in Sitka and John Ryan in Juneau. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C., Lori Townsend from the AFN convention in Anchorage, and Dave Donaldson from Juneau. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineers are Gooseberry Peter and Dave Waldron. John Prophet is our webmaster. And I'm Duncan Moon. From all of us here at the Alaska Public Radio Network, have a wonderful night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
First National Bank Alaska, serving Alaskans' financial needs for nearly a century. Member FDIC, equal housing lender. The University of Alaska, the home of award-winning faculty, students, and alumni, and offering 500 different degrees and certificates. Find one that's right and do something major. Information at alaska.edu. This message sponsored by the University of Alaska.
And by
the Rasmussen Foundation, partnering with Alaska's nonprofits and people to improve the quality of life throughout our state.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.